Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. He's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com, the place to get your latest and greatest Steelers information. And I'm David Todd at Season 8, Episode 105. And Dave and I are doing this Thursday, late afternoon, as we've got some conflicts coming up Friday. And just a heads up, our schedule will be a little bit on the fly over the next couple of weeks. Dave's going to be doing some traveling. We've got some things conflicting. So we'll probably be coming back at you on Monday. And kind of Mondays, maybe the next few weeks. But bear with us. We'll try to make sure we have it clear on Twitter and on the site. But, look for us next Monday, and we'll kind of play it by ear as we go forward. As things kind of slow down, we go into the, we're going to get into the OTAs, of course, and the mini camps. In terms of news, we've seen most of the news. So, Dave, we're just kind of wrapping things up here. We're actually almost exactly to the minute here, about 7 days away from the draft being done, the undrafted free agents being signed, teams kind of trimming the roster around a little bit when, as we've seen with the Steelers, with J.J. Wilcox and a couple other teams, Bryce Petty today, or the Jets gets waived. That's where we are with things in the big picture. And, we've got some topics, but, the big news is now mostly behind us.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I'm not embarrassed. We can tell the truth as to why the schedule is going to get changed up. I'm falling apart. I have issues, David. I have turned 50. I'm going to go in through for my 500,000-mile warranty tune-up and all like that. Lord, you ought to see the list of things my wife has in front of me. So, unfortunately, a lot of these are on a Tuesday kind of thing. So, that's in that in a 1 week in there, I'm going to try to get a mini vacation in. So, that's why I look for a lot of Monday shows here coming up in the coming weeks. But, yeah, look, the shock of the draft is over, I think, league-wide. We've seen a lot of teams obviously come to terms with their undrafted free agents. We've seen several other teams, make a few cuts on top of it that overly aren't surprising on top of that. So now teams will get their rosters ready for the rookie mini camps, which I assume some around the league will start this coming week. And obviously they'll all be, I think, taken care of the next few weeks here, but by the end of the next two weekends. And then on we go into the OTA period and those kind of things. So, I don't know where you kind of want to start. If you want to start about the NFL and the rule proposal, or Ryan
Schuster. Yeah, let's start there, because, this actually is something that I think is pretty interesting. And it seems to me maybe the NFL got this right. I mean, this is going to be a change that I think can have a real positive, and actually might bring an interesting dynamic into the kick return, rather than just everything being a touchback. So if you want to lay out the terms, then we can get into it.
Yeah, and this is per the ESPN report. I know a couple other, NFL Network and a few others have kind of written on this, but I like how they have this kind of bullet pointed here. Kevin Seifert does, of the proposed changes that will be written into a formal document by next week and presented to the owners for approval during their May 21st to 23rd meetings in Atlanta. They include, I'll run through these, coverage teams would lose the 5-yard head start they previously had on kickoffs. Second, 5 players would need to be aligned on each side of the kicker. So I would assume that that would go for onside kick as well. All wedge blocks, including 2-man double teams, would be eliminated. Another thing on here is 8 of the 11 return team members would be lined up within 15 yards of the restraining line, and blocking would be prohibited within those 15 yards. The next one is there would be no pre-kick motion, And the last.
Let me just ask you for the one thing I was unclear on, the restraining line. Is it currently 15 yards?
That's a good question, David.
I couldn't remember if it was 10 or 15, and I was just, I didn't pull up any video to look, get a quick answer. But so that was just, it's where the defense lines up, right? That's what that term means, right?
Yeah, I would assume so.
I've actually never heard that term used, restraining line.
Yeah,
so.
I've never heard it either. And outside of reading this article in the bullet points, I haven't dove deep into anything else related to this, but I mean, it makes sense of what you're saying there. There would be no pre-kick motion, and the last one is onside kick rules would remain largely unchanged. And the governing idea with all this was to reduce the space and speed of collisions that have historically occurred on kickoffs.
So let me just read. So can you read the restraining line thing one more time? Because it says here the line on either side of a football field. Okay, that's something different. That can't be the same thing. Okay.
You're thinking about sideline where players.
Yeah, they're talking about sideline thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But here's what that says. It says 8 of the 11 return team members would be lined up within 15 yards of the restraining line, and blocking would be prohibited within those 15 yards. The way that's written, it don't sound right, does it?
No, it's not 15 yards from the line of scrimmage. You would think that's what it would be. So we'll have to look into that a little more closely.
All right, we'll effort that as they like to say. But the general overall thing is kind of something that you and I've been kind of talking about now. It seems like for 5 years, the kickoff and the concussions and wondering if the kickoff at some point would be eliminated from the game of football. And there's no doubt about it. We're definitely headed in that direction. And one would think that if they don't get it right here with whatever, proposed changes get changed, the next step would be to eliminate it, right?
Yeah, that's definitely, and in fact, I don't know who it was, which one of the GMs said he was actually surprised that the special teams coaches came in with such a well-thought-out plan. They made a presentation. I don't know how the special teams coaches got together and, came up with the plan, but I think it was the Redskins special teams coordinator made the presentation. There were 7 or 8 other guys there. Danny Smith was not named, but Antoine Randall-El was apparently one of the guys in this meeting. And, I think the consensus had been, or at least there was a building consensus, that kickoffs might be gone as soon as this year. And so this proposal really, if you just visualize it, the idea is to make the play more like a punt. That's the objective, so that guys aren't running at each other from 30 yards apart at full speed. What you're going to have here, by having 8 guys on the receiving team needing to be on the restraining line, whatever we want to call that line, let's call it the restraining line. So they're 15 yards from the kick. What's going to happen is rather than them, immediately blocking the play, trying to block the players, pick off the players who were coming at them from 15 yards away, they're going to turn and run back. And, so every like a punt, everybody's going to be running in the same direction, and you're going to be pushing guys and trying to pick guys off that way rather than standing there still and trying to pick them off. So, that's the objective. That's what, if you want to get a visualization, that's why it's going to look like a punt. Now, to me, Dave, the really interesting aspect of this is all of a sudden you only have 3 guys back. And if you think about that, depending on how you want to position these 3 guys, there is going to be a ton of space between the 8 guys and the 3, kind of the 3, where let's say you put 1 guy in the middle and then you have 2 other returners back. All of a sudden, if I'm the kicking team, I'm thinking about all different things about, trying to kick a ball down the sideline 20 yards in the air and, see if we can have a contest to who gets the football. These little pooch kickoffs now to me are, look, NFL's hyper conservative, but if you're kicking it 30 yards down the field and teams have to have 8 guys on the line of scrimmage, all of a sudden it gets a lot more interesting because you remember on a punt, the defensive team, all they can do is down the football unless it's, unless it's touched. on a kickoff, that's a free ball. So you're bringing that into play, and I think this could be really dynamic in terms of teams, you know, down 10 in the second quarter or, you know, whatever. Instead of onside kicking, trying to pooch the ball into areas, and I do think the strategy of how you line up your return guys, your three return guys, now to me it's like you've got to have two guys at the 10-yard line and one guy deep because you can't afford to give up all that space in between. So that's going to be – you know, I find that to be the most interesting aspect of this.
So what you're saying is that what they're going to do is they're going to end up creating a situation where you have 22 guys essentially diving head first for a loose football 15 yards down the field.
I don't think that's out of the question. That's for damn sure.
So in other words, we have four concussions on a play instead of two.
Yeah. Right.
What do you think about the NCAA change that return teams will be allowed to fair catch kicks inside the 25-yard line, ensuing the drive will start at the 25-yard line?
Yeah, so I just heard about this, and, you know, I don't have a problem with it. I don't think it's particularly interesting necessarily. If you're, again, what do you tell your return guy who's, you know, it's not necessarily a guy trying to make a team like we talked about on our last episode, but it's, you know, a kid who's, you know, 20 years old who gets the ball at the 10, you know, on a normal kick, he's going to be like, well, I can get it to the 25 and it's no problem. So, He's gonna return the ball. The short answer is, unless the guy's catching it on the two, I think you tell the guy, well, go ahead and take a shot at it because, you know, maybe you hit a home run. It's college football, so I don't think it'll be. I guess my long way of saying is I don't think we'll see it be a prevalent used in a heavy manner.
Do you think the way some of these things are the proposal that we went over for the NFL? Do you think that that could potentially lead to longer returns? Return average league wide?
Good question. Don't know.
You don't have the running start on several of these players yet. The guy returning the kick.
You don't have the blocking scheme set up either, right? You don't have that kind of mid-level tier of blockers. So it's going to be harder to block guys. I would say it'd be the same, but I don't have any idea. I don't, you know, that's a really good question. I don't know. If I had to guess, I don't know.
It's going to be a wait and see mode, I guess.
I like the change, though. I do like it. I think it's good. Well, I think it will see what it's intended to achieve in terms of fewer, you know, hardcore contact.
You know, I like the cat and mouse strategy. I mean, look at back when Martavis Bryant had to return a few kicks and how teams would make sure that he had to field that thing on the ground at about the 1 or 2 yard line, you know? I would hate to see the kickoff go, you know. I don't think teams maybe do enough when it comes to kickoffs, you know?
Right. I'm with you. They could be a little more creative. That's why I gave Belichick props is – you know, anytime you get a penalty, you should be popping that ball to the goal, trying to pop it to the right to the 1 yard line all the time, in my opinion.
I wonder how many kickers, you know, you could get to land a kick within a yard or two range, you know, telling them to. You know, obviously.
I think they could do it 7 out of 10 times. Yeah, you say kick it to the 5, they'll get it between the 5, you know, between the kind of the 6 and the 4, you know, at least half the time.
Anyway, it'll be good, some good questions to hear answer, you know, for us to, you know, the commissioner or who, you know, the owners during this next owners meetings or whatnot to hear some of the comments that kind of come out of that and all. So, I'm for these proposed rules, you know, anything to A, you know, make the game safer, and B, you know, not do away with something that you and I have watched happen, you know, since we were born.
Yeah, right, totally. I'm with you. So that's why I'm psyched about seeing this and what happens and where it goes.
Okay, I think that's all the rule proposal kind of stuff. I think before we kind of get into talking about a little bit more about some of the draft picks, the Steelers on Wednesday decided to place, not shockingly, decided to place Ryan Shazier on the reserve PUP list. Now, normally players will start off training camp on an active PUP list, and then if they don't practice all of training camp, then come, you know, the start of the season, they're moved to the reserve PUP list, and then they are forced to miss the first, you know, whatever, you know, 6 weeks of the season, can't, you know, and then can't return, you know, can't begin practicing until the first six, and you know, the typical PUP rules that we've seen in the past. Now, obviously, the Steelers have long said now that Ryan Shazier's not going to play in 2018, so this move is more of a formality. It opens up a spot on the 90-man roster, and it's good that they're allowed to do a move such as this now so that they just don't have to eat up a roster space for a guy that's going to eventually, you know, his season's over with already here. Now, I wrote last night, Wednesday night, about how, you know, the expectations was because of Ryan Shazier having his fifth-year option being picked up, and because he was injured, and because he will miss, you know, he will now spend the 2018 season on PUP. Well, you know, and I talked to former NFL agent Joel Corey about this, and as expected, his contract will toll. And for those that don't understand or forgot, you know, we've seen contracts toll in Pittsburgh in the past. And when it comes to PUP guys, that, you know, it has to happen during your final season, okay? And that's why a guy like Mike Adams a few years ago had his contract toll after missing the entire, I think it was a 2015 season on the PUP list with a back injury. Now, that ended up becoming a mute point because the Steelers waived him with the failed physical designation the following May, even after his contract had tolled. And we have also seen a contract toll recently with Martavis Bryant, and that was because of him missing an entire season due to a suspension. So that's another, you know, you don't see normally contracts toll around the NFL, but, you know, go figure, the Steelers have had it happen twice just since, you know, the last couple of years here. Now, I think the little bit, now here is where it's going to get dicey, David, as far as some of the narratives that are floating around right now. It was reported on Thursday morning, I'm getting my days mixed up because we normally do this on Friday. It was reporting on Thursday morning that the Steelers turned a large portion of what Ryan Shazier was scheduled to earn in 2018, you know, the over the $8 million plus, into a signing bonus, and then, you know, didn't add any years to the deal, and basically, you know, no salary cap, you know, repercussions were caused because of that. You basically just took a large portion of his salary he was supposed to make and turned it into a signing bonus. And a lot of people say, well, why in the heck would you do that if you're not adding additional years? And the narrative popped up right away that, oh, the Steelers are a great organization to do this, that Ryan Shazier will instantly get this money now, this, that, and the other. Look, what I've been told, what I've talked to Joel Corey in the past about when it comes to signing bonuses, those things, you know, unless it's special stipulation, I think, those things are paid out over 17 weeks, just like a player's base salary is. Okay? So here is what I believe the real reason was why the Steelers turned a large portion of his $8.718 million salary into a signing bonus, and that is that his contract will toll after this season, and now it will toll at a minimum amount instead of tolling at $8.718 million. In essence, while this is good, you know, good for Shazier, it's also good for the Steelers, and let me explain to you why. If they had not done this, Shazier's contract would toll at $8.718 million. And that, of course, would be his cap charge on top of it next season. Now, who wants to carry a player that might still have, you know, be recovering from an injury with a cap charge of $8.718 million next offseason? You know, why wouldn't you, if the rules permit it, go ahead and turn a large chunk of his base salary into a signing bonus now, and when his contract tolls, it tolls at the base, at a minimum base salary. What that does is that it actually is helpful for Ryan Shazier too, because now it gives Ryan Shazier more time after the 2018 season is over to work on you know, on his way back to the NFL, if at all possible. And consider this. Let's say that they still have hope that Ryan Shazier will play. They could carry him on PUP again the following season, I believe, and at a minimal rate. In other words, the Steelers won't be toting a super large cap hit on Shazier, thanks to them now restructuring his contract essentially and paying him a large portion of the $8.718 million this year into a signing bonus. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
So
pretty straightforward stuff, to be honest, right?
Right, and here's the thing, though. It's being, you know, and I got to be careful with how I kind of word this, because Phil Yates and Adam Schefter and all are trying to frame this that, you know, what a great gesture. In fact, this is what Phil Yates tweeted out this morning. While there are no cap implications, it's a great gesture by a first-rate organization.
Yeah, which is not really accurate, probably, when you get down to it. And second of all, I've seen it reported, don't know the answer whether it's true, is that Shazier approached the team about this. Now, it benefits the team. It maybe benefits Shazier. Maybe it benefits everybody. I don't know who did what. But, yeah, you know, look, the Steelers are a first-rate organization, no question. I don't know that this was all about being magnanimous, but, you know.
Yeah, and
you know, for everybody, let's put it that way.
I've got a question into Joel Corey, you know, just to make sure that, you know, that Ryan Shazier will have to, you know, this will get broken up into 17, you know, his signing bonus will get broken up into 17 weekly payments, just as it would with any team. People tend to be under the assumption that a player, when given a signing bonus, sits down at that table, signs the contract, and gets this giant check, you know? And that's not the way it works, generally.
I was under that assumption, so you educated me.
You know, they get these all in 17 week payments, just like their base salaries are broken up into 17 weekly payments. So too normally is the signing bonus. Now, I'm not saying that there are instances out there maybe that have been different than that, but you know, that's in previous conversations that I've had with agents and former NFL agent Joel Corey, that has been the way players have been paid signing bonuses.
You're ahead of me, so I don't know the answer to that, but yeah, what I would think, whatever the normal process is he would, you know, follow the normal process.
Right. I mean, he was going to get that money either way. You know,
sure.
The money was guaranteed. Okay. I think the restructure and the turning it into a signing bonus, though, was more related to the salary, the
dealing with 2019 season,
right? How much of what it tolls at, you know, from base salary standpoint? I'm willing to bet you that's why it was done.
Yep, I concur.
Okay, one other thing, salary cap related. We've talked about Martavis Bryant getting traded. We've talked about J.J. Wilcox being cut. And pending the Steelers draft picks, getting inked, and the undrafted free agents signing their deals, all that, you know, will start happening once the rookie minicamp starts getting underway. But as of right now, for all practical purposes, the Steelers entered the month of May with a little more than $5.9 million in available salary cap space. I know whenever you say when you have that large amount larger than what they had, you clear up that much salary cap space in a matter of a few days with the trading of Bryant and the cutting of J.J. Wilcox, people's ears perk up as to ways the Steelers can start spending that. Well, I would sort of advise against that, because I want you to keep in mind that $5.9 million, do keep in mind that the Steelers like to keep roughly between $3 and $4 million in available salary cap space once the season starts for in-season transactions and signings and what have you. So we've already taken, let's say, $6 million and taking and earmarked $3.5 million for that. So we're down to what? $2.5 million. Now, in order for the Steelers to sign their draft picks and their undrafted free agents, they're going to use up probably just under another $2 million in salary cap space. So we're down to $500,000 in salary cap space there. Oh, and if that's not enough, the team still has to accommodate a 52nd and 53rd roster spot down the line and an 11-man practice squad. And, you know, that's at least another, you know, $1.82 million in salary cap space. So yes, the team is going to have more cuts down the line. Yes, the team is probably going to sign Chris Boswell to a long-term extension, and depending on how that's structured, that might create a little bit of a cap space or might eat up a little bit more cap space, depending on how the deal's done. And then obviously we'll see nobody's expecting Le'Veon Bell to get a long-term deal done. But if that gets done somehow, manages to get done by July 16th, then you could conceivably, you know, free up a little bit of cap space that way. What I'm getting at here is don't go spending the Steelers $5.9 million in available salary cap space that they have right now, because in essence, most of that's already earmarked already.
Yeah, look, the Steelers, you know, you have to believe they knew kind of they were going to have the J.J. Wilcox money all along. And so that was kind of probably went into their planning, and just, you know, they didn't know if they were going to get the safety they wanted in the first, second, fourth, fifth, you know, whatever. But they were going to add to the position. So J.J. Wilcox was insurance until, you know, they had the answer to that. They have the answer to that. The Martavis Bryant thing, you know, I'm willing to believe that it came out of the blue. Look, if you want to evaluate the trade, it doesn't look like a very smart trade for the Raiders. Now, if the Raiders, you know, if they love Bryant enough and they're willing to go, you know, they're willing to go to a second contract, and this is the way, you know, look, Bryant's going to be a free agent. It's not like the Raiders, you know, have the ability to kind of tie him up somehow. He is going to be a free agent either way. But, you know, he obviously will have the familiarity with playing for Gruden and playing in Oakland and the opportunity of going to Las Vegas, where he spent his season, you know, out of football, was in Las Vegas. So maybe that's all, you know, maybe that factored into their decision. That just kind of came to me now as I was talking. Maybe that kind of somehow factored into their decision making, and they feel like, you know, he's a guy that they can, that, you know, they want to have around long term. So, you know, again, I would be surprised if Kevin Colbert and Mike Tomlin knew 24 hours before Thursday that they were going to move Martavis Bryant.
I think they knew there was a possibility of it, just based on previous discussions. That they probably just kept saying, "Nah, Reggie McKenzie, don't call us. Nah, that's not enough." You know, maybe in the back of their head they're thinking, or maybe they were surprised. Boy, we can't believe he gave up a third. You know, maybe Kevin Colbert couldn't push that accept trade button fast enough. You know. Don't all war rooms have one of those? Isn't it like a Madden button or something?
Yeah, right. Yeah, bang. That deal's done. So, it's like an automatic trading system.
Something like that. We're kidding, of course, folks. But all right, what do you think about Matt Ryan becoming the first quarterback to land a $100 million guaranteed deal?
You know, all these things are just, they're just inevitable. You know, we know they're coming. You know, they're coming down the pike. They're, you know, he's going to get $30 million annually. The You know, we knew, look, the Kirk Cousins contract came in more or less where people expected. You know, we knew Ryan was going to be the guy. You know, it's gone Cousins. You know, before Cousins, it was Garoppolo's, you know, Stafford, and then Garoppolo, then Cousins at $28 million. You know, Ryan's a better, more proven quarterback than any of those guys, and Rodgers is going to be above him. So none of this surprises me. Quarterbacks are getting more guaranteed money. And the interesting thing will be over time, do any position players get more guaranteed money in terms of, you know, length of the deal, you know, past, you know, the typical 2 years? I don't expect that to change. So this to me is just a normal progression of, you know, ape to man. Just, you know, walking forward.
Dave to man. you know, Aaron Rodgers, you know, going to be next on this list at some point. You could probably go down the list of how, you know, how this is going to snowball in. And then, you know, the big question from that point is will Ben Roethlisberger be, you know, get another one? Will he be in this chain within the next 2 to 3, you know? Well, definitely have to be by... You would think it would have to be by the middle of March of next year. You know, if not, then odds are probably good that he's going to play that 2019 season without an extension signed, and then we'll have to go for there. And we've touched all over that in the last podcast, so there's not much to really add to that. Bruce Arians going to be in the CBS booth. What a great move!
Yeah, that'll be fun for everybody. Insightful guy, thoughtful guy, articulate guy. You know, Bruce Arians, we can say it was not the smoothest of transitions, as Bruce Arians was dismissed. And I think that's really the proper term to use at this point in time with all the information we have now.
You mean he didn't retire?
Yeah. So you know, it turns out it was the best thing that ever happened to Bruce Arians. I really believe it.
I think you're right. I really think you're right.
Went to Indianapolis as the offensive coordinator. Unfortunately for Chuck Pagano, he gets, you know, a cancer diagnosis. You know, fortunately survived it, obviously, but had to step away from the team. And Arians comes in and does a fabulous job, and it gets him a head coaching job in Arizona, which he had for, you know, I don't know, what is it, 4 years, something like that. And now he gets to – now, you know – if he was an offensive coordinator, he would never, 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 never have had the opportunity to be in the booth at a major network. You know, he's a not high profile enough guy, no matter how good you are at it. But they, you know, he's a high profile guy as a head coach, and here it goes. So, you know, him, you know, it didn't go down perfectly, I'm sure, in Pittsburgh, but it turns out to have been a wonderful stepping stone for him that, you know, he parlayed really well, and all deserved.
And it'll be good to hear an offensive-minded coach. I mean, look, we already have Tony Romo calling some games as well, right? You know, so it'll be good to hear another offensive-minded coach, you know, who knows quite a bit about defense as well, too.
Now, what do you think of the idea of Jason Witten in the Monday Night Football booth? Does that intrigue you, no view, or not intrigue you?
It intrigues me just because it's another player, another smart player who played the game a long time, that you would think knows quite a bit about X's and O's being in there coloring the thing for you. So, his press conference today wasn't, I'm the last person that needs to criticize people about public speaking and and all the things that go along with that. But I only co-host a podcast from my mom's basement. I'm not going to be coloring a game, on national TV. I'll be interested to see if he'll be able to pull it off, not from the knowledge of the game standpoint, just the gift of gab, I guess, and timing, and heck, you know all that. You're in broadcasting.
Yeah, no, it's this is one of those things where somebody went through the drill with him. It's, if you're an articulate guy and you lived life, you can probably speak reasonably well. So the transition, you know, for a guy like Tony Romo, the nuts and bolts of doing the broadcast are, yeah, they take a little bit of time, but that's not what he got hired for. And you'll get that, you know, if you're a smart guy, you'll figure that out very quickly, and you'll have people helping you. It's how to talk about the game. And you know, I think they backed him off as the season went on about kind of forecasting the plays and telling the plays, because as much fun as it was to watch initially, I think a lot of people didn't want to see that. What they wanted to, I think ideally what you want Tony Romo to do is say, look, this is what the defense is presenting as a quarterback, not here's what's going to happen. Here are the keys for me to look at. This is what I'd be thinking about, you know, maybe watch for this type of thing. And, you know, I think it was excellent at it. And I think that was why Tony Romo immediately got such great buzz, is he took you into the mind of the guy who's, you know, making it happen on the field. And that's what's fun. Will Jason Witten be able to do the same? I don't know. Look, no doubt that, you know, he can look at a defense and know what he's seeing as well. So it'll just be a different presentation. I'm sure there are plenty of people out there, you know, probably in New York and Philadelphia and Washington in particular, who are like, what the hell's with, you know, two Cowboy guys being on the national broadcast? You know, this is ridiculous, particularly if they, you know, end up – I imagine they probably don't call – they wouldn't put them on Cowboy games. But, you know, I don't care about any stuff like that.
Let me ask you this. I mean, you've obviously been around, you know, in broadcasting for a little while, even going back, I think, as far as back when you had the night call-in show. What was that, 104 –
Well, the Pirate Post Game Show, yeah.
That was, right. Have you at any point, maybe even in college, have you ever done play-by-play, you know, any of that?
I did a hockey game in college, and what you learn is, man, hockey's really tough. You know, it's probably by far the most difficult. I think, you know, one of the things about baseball is, you know, you have a lot of time to fill. So, you know, you tell, you know, you have stories and you, you know, talk about stats and, you know, tell things that aren't even related to the game. Football, I think, you know, football and basketball have a very nice pace to them. I think from a broadcasting perspective that you can, you know, hockey's moving fast enough that you can't actually describe every event that happens. Basketball happens quickly, but you have time to describe it. You know, in football, you know, you have a play and then you get a chance to talk about the play for, you know, a good amount of time. So, you know, football, I think I won't say it's easy, particularly if you're going from team to team, and particularly at the college level when your familiarity is, you know, not as strong. But yeah, I think that's the fun stuff. And, you know, certainly being an analyst, I think is probably more fun than being a play-by-play guy. For me, it would be more fun, but nobody's going to hire me to be an analyst. They'd hire me to be a play-by-play guy.
Well, and that kind of, you know, yeah, I think, I mean, you would do good in baseball, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think baseball, yeah, no problem.
And you know, as you said, football's kind of slow enough paced. You know, you had to play and then you talk about it. I mean, you could obviously do that as well, too. I get a kick out of
it. Yeah, anybody out there wants to hire me to be their lead play-by-play or analyst at the professional level or the college level, fire away. DMTodd1@gmail.com.
There you go. And you always get a good point. Doc Emmerich, boy, is – can anybody call a hockey game like he can?
Yeah, Doc's fantastic. And you know, if people listening, you know, the Penguins play the Caps tonight, next time you sit in front of a TV, spend 2 minutes and call the game. Try to call the game out loud. Just because, you know, look, I butchered it. First, you know, I would butcher it today. So I am in awe of people who do this well. And the key is obviously, as I say, it's different if you have a TV and you know people are watching, so you don't have to do it. But think about doing it on the radio. And you know, describing the game to people, it's just you know, if you have a chance tonight, try it at home for 2 minutes, and if you've never done that, you'll laugh at yourself and probably have a newfound respect for you know, hockey play-by-play guys.
Do you think a lot of people still listen to games? I mean, look, you and I grew up in the age of – I mean, I had to listen to games on radio. You know, if the Pirates you know, played the Braves or something like that, you know, you try to tune in.
Catch them on PBS.
You know, well, I mean, like, when they weren't on the cable, you know.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, look, yeah. I mean, I listened to, you know, every night. My dad and I would sit on the porch and, you know, I spent – yeah, I mean, way more. All the hockey games, you know, you're listening to most of those. Mike Lang, I grew up on that. That's the way I listen to games. And I know some people today who, you know, they just as soon listen to a baseball game on the radio. Just, you know, they might be doing other things. Obviously, people in cars, that's, the, you know, how they're hearing things. I don't know a lot of people who, if choosing, would listen on the radio, but I do know some people who listen to baseball that way.
Well, I know, and look, if you go to the game, I mean, why not have a headset and listen to the broadcast, you know, while in the stadium. You know, I could definitely see that. I just wonder
The only thing that's often difficult about that is you might have a 15-second delay, and that can be annoying.
I got you there. Okay, I guess suppose we should talk about one or two more of these draft picks, and I've been spending a lot of time, David, on James Washington, the Steelers' second-round draft pick out of Oklahoma State. I don't know how much you've watched of him or highlight since the draft has been over with, but boy, let me tell you, I've gotten a chance to dive way deep into a lot of his tape.
Yeah, and by the way, check out these articles. Dave's, you know, broken down just about every catch he's made. He's had some tweets up about, you know, catches longer than 25 yards and you know, in his 50-game career, comparing it to Bryant and all this stuff. It's really great work. And, you know, Dave, the thing is, you know, as you know, I don't spend a ton of time watching tape going into the draft, but I'm aware of a lot of players, and James Washington is certainly a guy I was aware of well, you know, during the past couple of college football seasons.
I think the most astounding thing from him, especially when it comes to the big play aspect, David, is that he had 57 of his receptions at Oklahoma State over the course of the four seasons there resulted in gains of 25 yards or longer. Now, the first thing that came to my mind when I was reviewing these were, how did these happen? You know, I mean, you could catch a bubble screen or a quick 3-yard slant and then run another 22 yards, right? You know, there's a big difference of when you say, you know, 25 or plus yard plays. You know, I think it's a big difference when breaking these down. And that was my goal going into this, was to find out how far down the field on these specific plays, these big plays that he had, you know, was he catching the football? In other words, you know, were there a lot of these bubble screens? Were there a lot of these 8-10 yard slants and him making a guy miss? Or were these legitimate down the field throws? And look, I pulled a lot of these, but I specifically went back through. Last year he had 19 of his receptions that gained 25 yards or more. And in going back through those, David, 15 of the 19 included him catching the football more than 25 yards past the original line of scrimmage. Okay, so that's fantastic. And those 19 receptions, in fact, those 19 receptions included Washington catching the football on average 34.4 yards past the original line of scrimmage. Now, don't forget who that quarterback was throwing him the football. He ended up in Pittsburgh too during this draft, in Mason Rudolph. But I found that quite intriguing, and in fact, you go by last year's play-by-play that I have broken down for you. Most of these passes that he had caught, in fact, just one of them, I think, was less than 15 yards that he caught the pass. Actually, two of them. He had one 13-yarder against South Alabama that he caught 13 yards past the line of scrimmage, and then added 53 yards of yak onto that. He had a ball against Baylor that he caught 14 yards past the line of scrimmage, and then ran another 54 yards after that for a touchdown. Now I haven't broken down, you know, the other 3 years, but I've looked at a lot of those plays, and the narrative holds true with that. Now, here's something that did stick out, especially with his big plays, and really all plays in general with him, is he lined up on the right side of he was on the right side of the formation for all 19 of those plays. Okay,
yeah.
So that's one thing that's quite interesting. We'll be able to see, you know, as part of his progression with the Steelers. I mean, obviously he's going to have to do more than just line up on the right side of the field. But we know he can do that. Can he have the same kind of production from the left side? And that's one of the things I'm going through his previous three seasons now to see if on the big plays, if I can find that. And then I'm going to go back through play by play and see, you know, how much He lined up on the left side, period, on any of that. Now, one other interesting stat that I had found, especially in his 2017 stats, is if you remove those 19 passes of 25 yards, you know, that resulted in gains of 25 yards or more, the other 55 catches that he had last season, he still averaged 11.5 yards per reception on. And that's not shabby at all, you know, throwing out the high-end catches. I mean, for 55 catches to average 11.5 yards and throwing out the ones that you knew resulted in gains of 25 yards or more, that's impressive on top of it. Now, some of the other things that I still am trying to go through, I haven't even looked at yet with James Washington, is the intermediate route running with him. And on top of that, to see how good he is as a blocker out on the edge, how willing he is and how good he is over the course of the four seasons. I've obviously found some instances of that by going through his tape already. I guess what I'm trying to say, David, is look, I have no idea how his career is going to end up, where it will go, but it certainly does look like the Steelers have the right guy here. And I did a breakdown in stats on that same post that you just referenced, or that I've been referencing here, of the receiving stats of the first 10 wide receivers selected in this year's draft. And Washington had obviously the second, you know, ended up having the second best yards per reception number at 19.8. And remember, he compiled that over the course of 50 games, which no one else, I think Calvin Ridley had, or Dante Pettis played in 48 college games, and Calvin Ridley played in 44. The rest were all under 40 games when you look at the top first 10 wide receivers drafted this year. Obviously, the 25-yard or more plays were impressive, and in fact, James Washington was the averaged 1.14 reception per game of plays that went 25 yards or more, you know, that it gained there. So overall, this is a very, very, very impressive kid, and I look forward to diving a little bit deeper into more of these specialized instances that we have. But I just, today I wanted to make sure I got with you and touched on the big play aspect of it. And Lord knows that we've seen, you know, and now that Martavis Bryant is gone, the Steelers need a player they can get out there on the field quickly that can hopefully, you know, the proverbial take the top off the coverage, and not only that, at least produce the big plays down the field.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting really to see, you know, how this works out. You know, what percentage of the snaps James Washington's playing early. Is he, you know, again, Eli Rogers is very squarely in this equation when you think about the Steelers wide receiver depth chart now. The question is, are any of the guys, you know, on the practice squad, the guys who've been signed to futures contracts, are any of those guys really in the mix? You know, how much are Hunter and DHB in the mix as wide receivers? Because, you know, I have to think right now, James Washington and Eli Rogers have a leg up on seeing playing time. And I, you know, I think I said, you know, on our Saturday morning podcast after after the second day of the draft, that, you know, I would expect James Washington to, you know, play 500 snaps. I mean, that's, you know, he can see, you know, he could, you know, but that might be low. I mean, you think about him seeing 30 snaps a game is 500. I would expect him to play 500 snaps this year.
Yeah, and there, I mean, look, they're going to use 11 personnel a lot, right? You know, and
yep.
You know, and the funny thing, you know, Eli Rogers, we keep talking about, he's not even under contract right now. But I mean, that's how kind of sure we are, I guess, right now at this point. I mean, I think I put him in my initial 53-man roster prediction, but which, by the way, you go back and look at, you know, we do this every year. The after the draft is over, we make initial 53-man roster predictions. And they are comical to go back and look at after the fact, David. I mean, do you realize what all has changed, you know, especially just from last year's 53-man roster prediction?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure, you know, 15 names are different.
I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I'm trying to find out where I don't think I have it in front of me here, the initial 53-man roster prediction from last year. But, I mean, it's absolutely crazy when you look at the name. Look at the cornerbacks alone. I mean, we were talking about Ross Cockrell.
Possibly.
Yeah, I mean, look at the guys that you know, I mean, Joe Hayden wasn't even in town yet.
Nobody knew who he was.
Yeah, Mike Hilton, nobody knew who he was at the time. And we were talking about Cockrell and Sensabaugh and you know, obviously Gay and a lot of those guys. And when you look at the, I mean, just it's fun to go back and look at them. I mean, we put them out every year, but just like mock drafts, they don't mean a damn thing. It's fun to go back and kind of look at these. And obviously they'll start probably progressing quickly from here on out. I mean, what's your thoughts on DHB right now? I mean, if you had to bet my house right now, is DHB going to make the 53-man roster?
So we had this conversation all last offseason about DHB, Gay, and Motes, and you know, they all made it obviously, and two of them are gone now. Let's put it this way, and obviously this is nothing on Darius Heyward Bey. I hope he doesn't make the team. I hope they've found a guy who can be as good, and then you know, whether it's you know, Quadri Henderson, the kid they drafted in the fifth round from NC State, you know, whoever, that, you know, they can fill that role with a younger player who can maybe bring more to the offense.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I mean, as big a fan as I have been of Darius Heyward Bey in the past and his contributions on special teams, enough's enough, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's right.
Real quick, here's my I pulled it up. My three running backs last year at this time on the 53-man roster: Bell, Niall Davis, and James Conner. I had six receivers. Oh, here you go. I had six receivers making the 53. Antonio Brown, Martavis Bryant, Sammy Coates, Eli Rogers, Juju Smith-Schuster, and Darius Heyward Bey. I think I'm obviously missed Sammy.
Not bad. Not bad.
Tight ends: Ladarius Green. Remember Ladarius Green?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was right. I mean, he was gone not long after this. But I had four make and David Johnson too. I had four tight ends making it: Green, James, David Johnson, Xavier Grimble. I had eight offensive linemen: Pouncey, DeCastro, Foster, Gilbert, Alejandro, Finney, Hubbard, and Hawkins.
That's accurate.
I think that was probably that's like a 2-inch gimme putt probably right there. Defensive linemen: Cameron Hayward, Tuitt, Hargrave, Tyson Alualu, McCullers, and Walton. I think I nailed that one.
Yep, that's right.
Linebackers: Shazier, Vince Williams, Steven Johnson, Tyler Matakavich. Steven Johnson was gone.
He made the team though. He made the team.
Did he make it initially? I can't remember.
He made the team. I think he made the team, yeah.
I can't remember if he was gone by then or not. I know I got at least three of those right. Outside linebacker: Bud Dupree, James Harrison, T.J. Watt, Anthony Ciccolo, Arthur Motes. I think I nailed all five of those.
Yeah, you only missed like three things, and they weren't, they were hard ones, so.
All right, cornerbacks: Burns, Cockrell, Sensabaugh, Cameron Sutton, William Gay, Brian Allen. Cameron Sutton obviously made it initially and then went to the IR. Cockrell obviously didn't, so swap out Cockrell for Joe Hayden. I guess I did okay there. And the four safeties I had were Mike Mitchell, Sean Davis, Robert Golden, and Jordan Dangerfield. Dangerfield, obviously, I don't think
it's all pretty good.
But I did have Colin Holba making it as a long snapper.
Yes, I figured, as we all did.
Okay, you got anything else you want to hit on before we...
No, I'm good. Getting ready for some hockey.
All right, you can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. Follow David Todd on Twitter at David M. Todd. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. A few more donations have come in. Thank you for that, big time. If you want to donate to the show, go to SteelersDepot.com, hit that donate button up right navigational bar. This show will go up on the web on Friday. David and I will be back on Monday, I think, next week with the next show. Enjoy the hockey game, folks.
As always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.